Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The recent massive power failure that left most of northern India without electricity has raised questions about whether something similar could happen here. The outage in India left 670 million people without electricity. That's more than the entire population of the U.S. So what does this reveal about the vulnerabilities of power grids? The electric grid here in the U.S. is more than 200,000 miles. We're talking about nearly 3,500 utilities serving well over 100 million people. Think about everything we rely on it for. All aspects of our lives, including transportation, our food and water supplies, communications, and health. We expect that electricity will be available at the flick of a switch. But what happens when that switch doesn't work? Because of higher than usual temperatures in Southern California and Central California, more people have been staying inside and using their air conditioners. On August 9th, and then again on Tuesday, the California Independent System Operator issued an alert asking citizens to decrease their power consumption during peak hours to avoid potential blackouts. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about our power grid. How vulnerable is it? What will it take to move towards a reliable, sustainable electric grid? Many people say that it needs to be modernized. What does that mean exactly? Carl Zakella is director of Western Energy Transmission with the Natural Resources Defense Committee. He oversees NRDC's national efforts to accelerate renewable energy development and transmission in an environmentally responsible manner that prioritizes the protection of wildlife and critical lands. Before joining NRDC, Carl was director for Western U.S. Renewable Projects for the Sierra Club, where he worked for 23 years. And Carl joins us from Washington. Hi, Carl. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Clark Gellings. Clark is an Electric Power Research Institute Fellow, where he is responsible for technology innovation scouting and scenario planning. He also advises senior management on technology strategy and areas concerning energy efficiency and power delivery. In June, Clark was appointed by U.S. Department of Energy Secretary Stephen Chu to the department's Electricity Advisory Committee, and Clark joins us from Palo Alto. Hi, Clark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. So there's so much to talk about with our electric grid. In researching this show, we all sort of wondered why we don't spend more time talking about this. I mean, in India, it was very hard to imagine that 670 million people were left without electricity. And it got us thinking, what if something like this happened in the U.S.? What issues did this raise for you, Clark? And why don't we spend more time talking about our electric grid?
Wow, what a question. Let's see. First of all, I think we need to recognize that the India system is quite a bit different than ours, in part because of the way it's grown. I mean, it's really not matured, if you will. Most of the resources, the generation in India is in the north, and then most of the people are in the south, and you've got essentially a bunch of skinny lines connecting the two, and that begs for instability. So anything goes wrong, and that system will kind of get out of whack. And in part, that explains why whatever happened, and we have some speculation about that, whatever happened could have caused that instability and allowed the northern grids, the northern three grids, to come apart. That probably won't happen in the United States, but I'll never say, I'm an engineer, I'll never say it'll never happen. But you certainly, as you already indicated, you'll never see 670 million people without power in the United States. But yes, we've seen 50 million, and that could happen again.
Mm. Carl, what are your thoughts? When you watched what happened in India, what issues did that raise for you?
Well, I think, you know, there are lessons to be learned, but I have to agree with Clark. Our systems are very, very different. I do think that the grid is changing in the U.S., and it's changing pretty fundamentally. In fact, it's hard to imagine another time since we initiated the electricity grid to see massive changes like this occurring in the industry sector. We're moving away from a baseload electricity model. We're gradually moving more towards a grid that is more flexible and resilient. This is being recognized by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the recent rules that it's been issuing about planning for the electricity grid and about operations. They have a rule that they've been promulgating on how to integrate more variable generation into the grid. In California, of course, with as much renewable energy as we're building in this state, it's a very important matter. The California Independent System Operator is very engaged on trying to figure out how to do this in the most reliable way that we can do it. And of course, there are many ways to do it reliably. It doesn't, just because the grid's changing doesn't mean it's going to really threaten the reliability. On the contrary, I think a more flexible and resilient grid with resources that are geographically distributed on the landscape, that's a mix of resources that complement each other, can give us a much more reliable grid, a much cleaner grid in terms of the emissions coming from that grid, both criteria pollutants, the stuff that we want to keep out of people's lungs, and the carbon dioxide emissions that we're trying to control with our global warming programs here in California. There's a lot of change happening on the grid. In the West, we're installing a $60 million program to install things called synchrophasers that give us better real-time information about what's happening on the grid. You know, we talk about the blackout in India, but we had a blackout in Southern California last September, almost a year ago now, that affected most of San Diego County. It started in Arizona and spread throughout Southern California and affected even northern Mexico. The fact is, what we learned there is, one of the most important lessons is we need better information about what's happening in the different parts of the grid. We need better coordination in how the grid is operated. And we need to be able to have more transparency between the operators so that folks can see what's going on. If they call situational awareness on the grid. So it's a lot we're learning from the things that have occurred, I think will make the grid more secure.
Yeah, and you brought up so many points there. And just to kind of step back a little bit, so our grid, I understand, is referred to as the largest machine ever built. We're talking about 200,000 miles. And a couple of years ago, NPR had a week-long series about our U.S. electric grid, and there's this great graphic visualizing the grid, and we have a link at yourcallradio.org, and it's got all the lines that are crossing, and in the East Coast, there's just so much activity going on, but as you move west, there's not as much. And so, Clark, what else do we really just need to know about the electric grid? 200,000 miles, the infrastructure represents more than about $1 trillion in asset value. 320,000 kilometers of transmission lines operating at 230,000 volts. What else do we need to know about the grid?
You've done your homework. I think Carl raised a good point about awareness. So as we do sort of a forensic analysis on major blackouts around the world, and we do this because we want to learn from them, and we want to try to understand what went wrong there, and you know, can we apply that somewhere here in the United States? And as we do that analysis, one of the things we find is that we don't always have good situational awareness. In the early data from India, this is particularly coming to bear. So we have a system, that's, as you said, the National Academy has said it's the most complex machine ever built, and we operate it in a way that we use computers to see what's going on. The reason we do this is because it's so complex that you just can't sit there and look at one dial or one meter. You've actually got to have a computer sample a bunch of points, insert data where at that point didn't happen to report at that moment, and then make a condition assessment of that, and that's called state estimation. And that process takes, the fastest I've seen it done is in 20 seconds. So here we are driving, it's like driving a car at 100 miles an hour, looking, using our rearview mirror. We don't yet have the technology that gives us good situational awareness immediately, or if you'd like to say, in real time. And until we do, we will always have at least the risk of some kind of event that causes perhaps a whole area to go black. A fundamental problem with the power system is that it's mechanically controlled. We're so spoiled with all of the electronics around us that operate things so automatically and ubiquitously for us that we forget that the power system is mechanically controlled. Mm. Until we move technology to the point where it is, in fact, electronically controlled, we will always have a problem with being able to react quickly to any kind of disturbance.
So the entire grid is mechanically controlled?
Essentially, yes. There are a few places where we use electronic devices, but it's minimal.
And in your opinion, it should move to an electric-controlled grid?
Oh, absolutely. We've been working we're working hard on a set of technologies that would help us do that. We've got a few installations. They're expensive. And one of the problems, one of the realities of moving to a modern grid is that it's going to cost. These distributed resources that Carl made reference to often are more expensive than central generation resources. The kind of controls that I'm inferring by saying that we need to automate it, have a more digital system, the communications that needs to be overlaid, and then the implications that come from having a digitally controlled system, like cybersecurity is an implication. We didn't have to worry about cybersecurity when there wasn't communications overlaid on the grid. But now that we're starting to do that, we buy ourselves another problem. I mean, it's a problem we need to solve, but it's a problem.
And how much money are we talking here?
Oh, there's been a number of estimates done, but we are talking about billions of dollars of investment that are going to be necessary over the next 20 years. Now, before we get all frightened about that, I mean, it's the equivalent of about a pizza pie a month for the average consumer. So it's not an extraordinary amount of money when you think of it that way, but still it represents a substantial investment in the infrastructure.
I think, you know, I'd like to point out, too, that everyone is standing on the shoulders who made the initial investments over the course of the last 40 or 50 years.
Yes.
You know, we have to make these improvements, not like we have a choice. The grid's going to be different than it was. We're going to have a grid that is more flexible and resilient than a grid that was built to service baseload generating plants that operate all the time. We're using less coal. We're using less nuclear power. We're using, in many cases, less of the slower ramping natural gas plants. We're going to be moving to a system that is interactive and, as Clark's putting out, you know, is really involving a lot of instantaneous communication. The good news is I think by and large we understand what it is we need. The scope of the installation is so huge. You know, you have to incrementally begin, and getting better information, better situational awareness is a great place to start, and then work to the controls. In the western United States, you know, the grid is thought of as a thing, but it's really a thing that's operated by 37 individual grid operators called balancing area authorities in the west. Now, it's a little bit like having a truck with 37 drivers, you know, and they're not all talking to each other in exactly the same way. You have to have the ability to operate the grid in shorter intervals, what they call sub-hourly scheduling and dispatch, to be able to make the grid respond to imbalances in the system. The thing that makes the grid work so well is it's synchronized at a certain speed. So you can have, or a certain frequency, I should say. You have to maintain that frequency within certain tolerances or the grid doesn't work. It starts to fail. It can break down and collapse. And in order to do that, you have to have energy controlled and inputted from your generating sources to keep that frequency at that level. And that requires a much different way of operating a grid. We can't have a really truly secure and reliable grid with 37 grid balancing area authorities in the West. That's going to have to change. But that is a political and even a psychological change among the people who operate the grid. That's not going to be that easy to overcome.
Well,
people recognize it needs to happen, but they don't like the idea of losing their hold over their part of the system.
Well, that was the next question, is who actually owns the grid? Who makes these ultimate decisions? Clark?
Let's see. It's owned by a variety of entities, at least predominantly about 200 utilities of the 2,700 or so that exist. About 200 of them own some piece of the grid. The operation of it is dictated by over 100 entities. You know, Carl mentioned 35 or so here in the West, but, you know, there's many across the country. And in some sense, you might say there's a good reason for that, and part of the good reason is our inability to integrate it effectively with regard to communications and control. And this same problem I said about, you know, responsive and rapid control, that the ownership is changing. There are a couple of states that have done some consolidation where they've taken grid ownership from three or four utilities and they've merged them into one entity. In fact, in many cases, the utilities themselves have initiated this. So there's some indication that we might move in the direction that Carl suggests. There's a lot of political barriers to this. And, of course, if you talk about ownership and it's a publicly traded company that's owned by stockholders and bondholders, then there are obligations that the management has towards those who've made investment. And we can't just unilaterally change that arrangement.
We have a comment from a listener who says every time you turn around, PG&E is asking for more money. Can you talk about how that relates to today's discussion? What would you say, Carl?
Well, it depends on what they're asking for money for. I think the grid upgrades are things that are spread out among all customers, all beneficiaries of those changes, whatever you're making. And that tends to mean that those costs are very low for individual consumers. Transmission costs and grid-related upgrades are, while they are very expensive, no question about it. When you look at the universe of people that are participating and paying for those things, as was mentioned earlier, it's not as enormous a challenge as you might think. There are certain things we have to do for security reasons, for safety reasons. If we don't do that
stability.
And reliability, of course.
Right.
If you don't do those things for, to stay abreast of those things, you have San Bruno-like situations where infrastructure gets old. It doesn't keep up. You need to continuously upgrade it. And there are more of us, and there continue to be more of us, that are going to need the services of the system. So, they're going to be needing additional resources, but it's not just PG&E that will be doing these things. It is also going to be done through a planning process that involves the regulators that make sure ratepayers are only paying fair rates. It will be involve the planners at the California Independent System Operator, which actually runs the grid for the investor-owned utilities in California. And it'll involve the publicly owned grid operators, too, because these upgrades are not limited to the investor-owned part of the grid. There are those entities like LADWP, which are really city agencies, in essence, that are operating pretty major generating systems and transmission systems to go along with them. And they have to make these upgrades, too. Luckily, there's a lot of us helping to pay for them.
And that is Carl Zakella, Director of Western Energy Transmission with the National Resources Defense Committee. We're also joined by Clark Gellings, an engineer. He's an Electric Power Research Institute Fellow, where he's responsible for planning and technology innovation scouting. And today we're talking about our electric grid. It's called the most complex machine ever built, over 200,000 miles, serving well over 100 million of us. When you think about what you rely on, we're talking everything from food and water, health and communications. If the power goes out for just a couple of hours, people don't know what to do with themselves. We're having a lot of road work done in my neighborhood, and the neighbors freak out when the power goes out. They just don't know what to do with themselves. So what are your thoughts about the electric grid and how it works? What questions do you have? We're raising a lot of issues here. This rarely gets discussed, but it's so important. How vulnerable is this? What will it take to modernize it? We're talking about billions of dollars. We'll also talk about some of the political questions involved in this. Do you know where your power comes from? Have you ever experienced a power outage? Do you work in this field? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have a question from Richard who says, I last heard that the problem in San Diego was human error. What did we learn from the San Diego blackout, and what steps were taken to prevent a similar blackout there or elsewhere?
Carl, you might be closer to that than I.
Sure. Actually, that blackout started at a substation in Arizona. It was a test that went wrong. It started a cascading series of effects across the grid where parts of the system failed. And it once it started to fail in earnest, it stretched all the way to the San Onofre nuclear power stations, which it tripped out of service, causing much of San Diego, Southern California, Northern Mexico, and parts of Western Arizona to go black. The things that we learned there had a lot to do with the things we were talking about a little while ago, and that deals with what's called situational awareness, and being able to see what's happening in the neighboring balancing area authorities. We, California Independent System Operator, did not have a good idea of what had happened in Arizona. They took them a long time to be able to reconstruct what was occurring so that they could set the system up. They can bring the system back up. It took probably hours longer than it otherwise would have if there was transparency, if they could see what was going on in the neighboring balancing authorities, including Mexico, by the way. Because a big chunk, well, I shouldn't say a big chunk, a chunk of northern Mexico is part of the same western grid that California participates in. And, you know, they had a power failure that affected San Diego Gas and Electric's headquarters. And in the early hours of that, you had utility engineers and executives communicating with each other by text on their cell phones. Hmm. So, you know, we did have a lot of lessons learned about how to improve those communications between balancing authorities. And this is going to be a major focus. It is a major focus for the North American Electricity Reliability Council, which oversees reliability standards for the grid, and the Federal Electricity Regulatory Commission, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which did a joint review of this blackout, came up with a lengthy set of recommendations, a lot of which focused on these communications failures and the balkanization of grid operations that led to it. So we have a really good sense of what to fix, and I think people at the Western Electricity Coordinating Council, which enforces many of these reliability standards, are really taking it seriously, as you might imagine. And there's ongoing and constant collaboration in trying to identify ways to meet the requirements of what FERC and NERC are requiring.
Well, thank you for the question, Richard. And let's take a phone call before we go to break. Let's hear from Philip in San Francisco. Hi, Philip.
Hi. I happen to be right near your studios. I'm at the moment, I'm a resident of Bernal Heights. I'm calling to discuss briefly the history of the whole electrical system, how in the early 20th century, Nikola Tesla, who invented AC electricity, had developed a system by which four towers were to be built around the United States that would take the power literally from the cosmos. There's a big differential in power between the atmosphere and the ground, and he figured out how to connect into this and then rebroadcast it out in a biologically harmless way. You'd buy a one-time purchase of a small Tesla coil to power your electric car, a bigger one for your house, and a little bigger one for your factory, and then you get free electricity for life. J.P. Morgan was financing both him and Edison, and Tesla used to work for Edison, but they split over this. This Edison system, you put up wires, and you could put a meter on it, and then you'd have to pay into the system forever. There's a lot of research now into wireless power transmission, so I encourage that we go back in that direction and recover the patents and so on that Tesla developed so long ago and build a truly sustainable system.
All right. Well, Philip, thank you for the question. We'll get a response right after a break. Today we are talking about our electric grid, 200,000 miles, called the most complex machine ever built. When we come back, we'll talk about the political questions involved in this, and we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll discuss coverage of the Justice Department's decision not to prosecute Goldman Sachs in a financial fraud probe. We'll also talk about the trial of the Russian protest rock band Pussy Riot and freedom of expression in Russia. That is tomorrow. And then on Monday, as teachers head back to the classroom, we will talk about what we can do to support them. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about our massive electric power grid, over 200,000 miles, serving more than 100 million customers. And it is referred to as the largest, most complex machine ever built. And we're talking today about the history of the grid, how it works. What does it mean to modernize this grid? What are the political implications? And if you have any questions about the grid, we'd love to hear from you. If you've ever experienced a blackout, so many of us take all of these things for granted. It serves our food and water supplies, health, communications. If you work in this industry, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on what our guests are saying today about the need to modernize the grid? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Carl Zakella, Director of Western Energy Transmission with the Natural Resources Defense Committee. He was also Director for Western U.S. Renewable Projects with the Sierra Club for 23 years. Clark Gellings is an engineer and an Electric Power Research Institute fellow. And before we get to more calls, Carl and Clark, what are your thoughts on Philip's call and also the history of the electric grid? Clark, what are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting point. First of all, Tesla's experiments didn't work. He was never able to prove that he could get energy from the cosmos. But he clearly made a huge contribution, obviously, by applying the so-called Lorentz force, enabling the ability to actually have alternating current supply. But the interesting thing about the whole Edison-Westinghouse debate is that we're actually revisiting it in the way that we might actually now see direct current more ubiquitously used, because it actually is embedded in all our personal computers and fax machines and the like. We're actually getting to the point where we're now looking at data centers and the like and thinking about powering them by direct current. Fascinating concept, and it does borrow absolutely from Tesla's work.
And just to add, I think the newer applications for direct currents for long distance transmission are becoming increasingly interesting too. Some of the technologies can help us solve transmission line routing problems in the future when we look at superconducting direct current lines, where you can have up to 600 kV or above. That's a very large capacity line in a conduit that's chilled with nitrogen or some other substance, and then routed in a transmission line corridor that could be as small as 4 feet. These are under exploration, I would say, right now. There's a very big project on the books to connect up the major interconnections in the United States. The national grid isn't one big chunk. It's in three big chunks in the lower 48. The eastern interconnection is about, I think, 37 states or so, and western interconnection is everything from the Rocky Mountain front west. It includes two Canadian provinces and, as I mentioned, a bit of British Columbia, Baja California. And there's a third one that is basically Texas, the Electricity Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT.
Yeah, I thought that was strange. How did that happen?
Well, that could be a whole show. ERCOT was established because they did not want to be regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission or the federal government. And instead of being connected to the rest of the grid very directly, they have minimal connections to the rest of the electricity system in the United States.
Huh.
The proposed project is called Tres Amigas. It's a superconducting DC hub to connect all three of the interconnections up and allow for a electricity market, particularly beneficial potentially to renewable energy, between the Southwest, the Western Desert Southwest, and other parts of the Eastern Interconnection. So we're seeing sort of a reconsideration of DC technologies for long-distance lines. And for a conventional high-voltage DC, some of the remote renewables are hundreds of miles away from the load centers. California, for example, buys energy from Utah and from the Pacific Northwest that already uses DC lines coming long distances into the state. We may find other DC lines being built from Wyoming, Montana, and other parts of the Northern Plains, Northern Rockies, where there's unbelievable wind potential. And the wind energy in that part of the western United States is among some of the very best in the world. So the possibility of seeing, we are seeing a revival of DC lines for sure for that purpose. There's fewer line losses as well from DC lines, less of a thermal issue with the lines. Alternating current lines create heat. In addition to transmitting electricity, they lose a certain amount of electricity over longer distances in particular. And they're prone to having problems related to sagging of the lines and other issues and high heat events that affect their efficiency. So alternating current is extremely important, useful technology because you can connect generators just about anywhere along the system. With DC lines, it's extremely expensive to add power sources along the length of a line. It's good from a point to point, but each individual converter station could cost several hundred million dollars to build. So
well,
I don't see that used very much.
And we have full lines, so we actually have a lot of interest in this issue. So let's try to get to as many as we can, and then we'll get responses from our guests, Carl Zakella and Clark Gellings. Let's hear from Jim in Santa Cruz. Hi, Jim.
Hi. What I was calling about was just a comment on the consequences of a power outage. I work as an x-ray tech, and a few years back I was working in a hospital in Santa Clara, and we had a power outage five blocks on all sides of that particular hospital. Well, the CT scanner did not have any emergency backup, and if you were a stroke patient, depending on the type of stroke that you had, that could actually be a life-changing event because of the difficulty of diagnosing it without a CT scan just becomes much more difficult. So it's just something to point out that it can have great consequences in emergency situations.
Right.
One survey we did a few years ago indicated, without even thinking about loss of life, that we lose in our economy some $186 billion a year as a result of poor power quality and blackouts.
$186 billion?
Yes.
Wow. Well, thank you for that, Jim. It's important to remember that. Let's hear from Lewis in Monterey. Hi, Lewis. Welcome to the show. Hello, Lewis. Let's try Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, yes. Good morning. I just wanted to point out that in many countries, including Iraq, didn't have that problem before the U.S. invasion. And in Afghanistan also, it's very common to have electricity blackouts as well as not electricity, and many businesses also have generators. In Germany, they're preparing for a non-nuclear future, and they're telling people you have to be prepared to be, sometimes things just aren't going to work, and similarly in Japan. So I think that this whole system we need to dramatically curtail our use of energy, which of course is not practical for the energy companies because they depend upon selling more product. And we don't want those corporate bonuses to go down from the millions that they are now, do we? So I think that's an important point to consider, that when people complain or whine about a little bit of inconvenience in your neighborhood, people have to go through that every day
right.
in many countries, including most recently in India.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, Clark, what do you think about this? I remember during the Enron blackouts, California did a pretty good job of conserving. But then once the calls for conservation ended, everyone went back to normal.
Oh, gosh, yeah, out of sight, out of mind. We know that we can see even as much as a 15% decrease in usage on a short-term basis. Programs that I used to run back in the East when I worked for a major utility, on a critical hot day, we could count on, through the TV ads and radio and so on, and phone calls. We had a system set up where we'd call all the large customers. We could count on as much as a 15% reduction on the first hot day. Now, the second hot day, you'd see a little less. And by the fifth hot day, you'd see practically nothing. People just expect that electricity is like air, ubiquitous. It's an entitlement. They don't recognize how it's produced or the consequences of its production, nor do they appreciate when people call for, like we call in California, flex alerts.
Right.
We're serious.
Well, and so, for example, the California Independent System Operator, and we did invite them, but they weren't available to come on, they issued a flex alert on Tuesday and then another one on August 9th. What happens when these flex alerts are issued? Do people actually conserve?
Yes, they do. Evidence suggests that they do conserve. As if it's just a flex alert, that is to say, where the media is engaged, and incidentally, now email blasts are sent to major companies in California as well, you'll see potentially a 5% reduction. I haven't checked the statistics lately here in California, but actually we're working on more sophisticated systems to get customers to respond where they actually may get incentives in some way. These are called demand response programs, and there's a variety of them. But basically, we'll send out signals, not we, but the industry will send out signals. And in those signals will be received by some device that's installed in your home or your building to at least directly alert you, and maybe even, if you allow it, to directly control appliances and other things in your building so that you get a response, this demand response, which reduces the demand at the time. If as long as you don't operate that a whole lot, if you're a utility or a California system operator, it works great. Another problem with that, of course, if you operate it more than 5, 10, or 20 days a year, people get bored with it, and they'll drop off if they can.
And that is Clark Gellings. He is an engineer and an Electric Power Research Institute fellow. We're also joined by Carl Zakella, director of Western Energy Transmission with the Natural Resources Defense Council. We're talking today about our electric grid, the most complex machine ever built, over 200,000 miles long, serving well over 100 million of us. And if you have any questions or comments about the grid, we've got one line open, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org, or better yet, leave your comment at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Harvey in Berkeley. Hi, Harvey.
Hi, Rose, and thank you for the show. And hello, Clark and Carl. And well, I feel that the decentralization of electricity production is true homeland security. And it seems that on sunny days, that's when the blackouts seem to happen on sunny days when everybody's turning the air conditioner. And I say that there are millions and millions of rooftops, both commercial, residential, and otherwise, in California. And I say cover them with solar panels and absorb a lot of that. That could compensate for the air conditioners. And also the plug-in electric cars are coming. So I think that every building, that's out there, especially commercial buildings. If you go to Google World and you can drift over California, you can see how many rooftops are available. So that's the way to go. And I think that we have the technology. You can use solar panels or solar electric roof shingles.
All right. Well, Harvey, thank you. But we'll get a comment about solar after we go through just a couple more calls because we have full lines. Let's hear from Dara in San Carlos. Hi, Dara. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My question is, my husband and I, for many, many years, worked down at the San Onofre Nuclear Power Station. And I know now that the units are down. And so my question is, I know that it would take, billions of dollars to invest in retrofitting the whole plant for today's standards, but instead of putting all that money towards that, are they going to put the money towards investing in solar, wind, and wind power? And so that's my question. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dara. We'll get to it in just a couple minutes. Let's go first to Mark in Santa Cruz County. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm interested in something called community choice aggregation. Marin has done it. They've gone through the legal battles to fight PG&E, and essentially a local county or aggregate of counties can use the monopoly's power grid system but set up an alternative so the community can choose to buy power from, say, a local nonprofit. And therefore, the profits could be returned to the local county. You've got job creation, investment in local solar or wind or what have you. This seems to me to be a very powerful concept. I'm curious what your speakers have to say.
Yeah, thank you. We've been meaning to do a show about this. So thanks for the question. And we'll get to that. We'll take one more question, then we'll get comments. Let's hear from Leslie in San Francisco. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. Hey, I grew up in Imperial County in Southern California, and the Imperial Irrigation District was in control of the power grid down there. Mainly they were using water that ran the turbines to for irrigation. But I know that I was just wondering about how the grid was going to be affected by lower rainfall, and we do have like a treaty with Mexico that allows them or gives them certain amounts of Colorado River water. So in times of drought, how is the grid going to be affected by that? And how are those fluctuations going to be controlled or minimized?
Yeah, thank you. Great question. Carl, do you want to address that one?
Sure. I mean, it is a great question, and the forecasts with climate change are for less water in the future than more. And it will affect just basically all of our hydro systems, our pump storage in California, which, you know, we're lucky to at least have Helms. We don't have a lot of that. It's one of the only ways to store electricity. You know, it's hard to store electricity otherwise. We may get more battery technologies and the like, but for the moment, we don't have them. I do think that we are seeing a lot more of an emphasis in dry-cooled energy resources in California. Virtually all of our solar, our concentrating solar, with, I think, a rare exception, are going to be dry-cooled. So with that in mind, it's one of the limiting factors for new large fossil plants is the amount of water it takes to run them is probably not going to be feasible in the future for large coal-fired power plants, and those with carbon capture and sequestration, which takes even more water, are going to be unlikely, I think, to be seen in the arid areas of the West. I do think the trend is to see individual grid operators like Imperial Irrigation District combining with their neighbors. In fact, recently, Imperial signed a memorandum of understanding to develop transmission resources with San Diego Gas and Electric, which is an investor-owned utility. So for the first time in a very long time in California, you're seeing a partnership between a public and a private utility to build and share transmission resources. And I actually think it's a very healthy thing. The less confusion there is in the operation of the system, the easier it's going to be to coordinate and operate and make it more reliable. So I think water will be a very limiting factor. There's no question about it. It'll affect the resources that are available to us by limiting hydro. It'll affect the resources that are available to us by limiting the amount of water that's available for cooling. And it will increase the importance of resources like wind and solar, which are not going to be very water-intensive resources.
Well,
it will require balancing from each other, those resources, and from combustion turbines that can cycle very quickly.
Well, thank you for the call, Leslie. And speaking of wind and solar, Clark, do you want to take Harvey and Daria's call about solar? And Daria's concerned about investing in nuclear when she believes we should be investing in solar and wind and other alternatives.
Sure. This is not an easy answer. First of all, I think we all want as much of wind and solar as we possibly can get. And we got to keep an eye on the economy of doing so. And for, at least for some time, wind and solar have been more expensive. We've used production tax credits and things of the like to bring wind energy costs down. They're still a bit out of reach if you take those tax credits away. But obviously, the technology development might bring it within reach so that we could see more and more wind develop. Somewhat the same with solar. The good news there, though, is that the prices of solar panels and modules have come down enormously, and they're almost to the point where they're competitive with the power system, if you will. Both of those resources, though, aren't the same as having generation that you can control and operate 24 hours a day. Hmm. Obviously, wind blows intermittently, sun doesn't shine at night, and so on. So bottom line of that is the best we can get out of a wind system is about a 20% capacity factor, we call it. That is to say, maybe even 30% in some really sunny areas, to say that, well, the sun doesn't shine all the time, what am I going to do with this? That sort of thing.
Have you, or has anyone looked at how the grid would be affected if we did embrace wind and solar?
Oh, yeah. There's been some very, in fact, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory is about to release a study that shows a very high penetration of wind and solar and lays out a grid that would enable it to happen. It's just an engineering problem for the most part. And there's
That's
a cost
right.
to it, but there's just it's something we can deal with. Right now, the best estimate we have is that you could do a couple of percent of wind or solar without any adverse impact on the system. And I'm generalizing here across the country.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to interject, though, if I may,
sure.
and just say I think that we're seeing recently in big grid segments of the grid, like the Midwest Independent System Operator, they have integrated large amounts of wind, about to integrate many more. And because they have geographic diversity, the wind is spread out over a large area, and where it's blowing in one area, it may not be blowing somewhere else. They're able to match those resources up. And they're having, and they told their board in February, their market committee told their board, they have no problem integrating large amounts of wind into their system because of this geographic diversity, and they have a good overall control of their system area, which is about 11 states. So I think that it's clear what we can do and how we can do this. And I have to say, the capacity factors of wind, recent studies are showing they're much greater than they were previously thought to be. The wind in Wyoming has a capacity factor of about 40%. That's close to a natural gas plant.
Wow.
And they're finding in the Midwest system operator area that they can dispatch wind. In other words, they can decide when to turn it on based upon the forecast that they have. That's another key component of understanding and integrating renewable energy, is it's not like you don't know what's going to happen. You can forecast the fronts coming in. You can forecast when the clouds will be over parts of the system. You can operate the system where you're integrating renewable energy from where it is producing to offset some of the areas where it isn't producing, and then match it up with the rest of your system. In the West, we have a large number of natural gas plants. They're about used 30% of the time. Overall, some of that is peaking plants that are used very seldom. But by and large, we have some extra capacity in the gas fleet that can help us balance, make up the differences when the wind and solar are cycling up and down, that intermittency that was mentioned earlier. So we have a great advantages in the western U.S. and in large parts of the east as well, as is indicated by the MISO, the Midwest Independent System Operator system, to do this and do this in a very efficient way. We have to have the kinds of communications we talked about earlier. We have to have the interoperability so that the one balancing area and another are very well closely coordinated. And that will save us money, too, because then we can share contingency reserves and operating reserves, so that if things start to happen in one part of the grid, another part can help them out.
And I'm sorry to cut you off, but we have just a couple minutes, and I want to make sure we get to our last couple of questions. Just quickly, what about Mark's question about local power? Clark, do you want to take that briefly?
Sure. In some areas that could work very effectively. The thing you need to keep in mind is, even though you might be creating some jobs, there's an enormous amount of taxes that the investor-owned utilities pay to the local municipalities. One of them is something called gross receipts and franchise taxes. So for every pole, for every transformer, for all the wire that's strung, they pay something like 25% of the revenue, depending on the state, to the local municipality. If you do the math and that works out in your favor, go for it. But I haven't seen too many studies where it comes out positive.
And we don't have time to take Chris, who's calling from St. John, Virgin Islands, our first call from there. He found us online, and I hope you call again, Chris. I'm sorry we can't take your call, but we're almost out of time. He says that they're using wireless transmission technology in the Virgin Islands. Will this ever be used here?
There are limited applications for wireless transmission technology, in part because just the basic concept of taking a lot of energy and putting it through the air. If we think about it, we got to be awfully careful what gets in the way, planes, birds, whatever it may be. It's not as straightforward as it seems, and this could be a subject of an entire call by itself.
Okay, well, thank you for calling, Chris. Lucky you for being in the Virgin Islands. And we have a great last question from Richard. He says, what actions are being taken by Congress or urged by politicians to deal with this monumental and vital issue? What politicians have taken leadership on this? Carl, you're in D.C. Do you want to take that one first?
Well, I think that there have been a number of people that have been in the lead in trying to identify and strengthen the grid. Senator Harry Reid of Nevada, the Senate Majority Leader, introduced legislation to improve the grid. So did Senator Jeff Bingaman, who's leaving Congress now after a long and distinguished career. We've seen a number of Senate and House members try to take this issue on. Unfortunately, like many other issues, this is a casualty of the current polarized political moment, and I don't expect anything of any significance to be adopted in the remainder of this Congress. And we'll have to see what happens after the election.
And Clark, in about a minute, you talked about the political implications here and the questions that come up with the grid. Can you just tell us more about that?
Well, for one thing, let me use an example quickly. Even if we want to use increasing amounts of wind power and energy, I've worked with some utilities who were very interested in doing so, and when they went to their state regulators looking for permission to build transmission lines that would have to cross an adjoining jurisdiction, they were turned down because, in fact, that transmission line wouldn't benefit that local jurisdiction. So these problems we have with siting transmission lines, which lead to a debate sometimes between the federal authorities and the state authorities, are the problem I was referring to.
Okay, and then we also, in the presidential election, we're hearing a fight between wind and coal. And hopefully these issues will get some more attention in the coming months.
If you had the time, I'd say, you know, we need all these resources, every one of them, including nuclear, coal, wind, natural gas, solar.
Clark Gellings is an engineer and an Electric Power Research Institute fellow. Carl Zakella is director of Western Energy Transmission with the Natural Resources Defense Committee. Thank you both for joining us. We'll definitely continue this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you so much for all of your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss media coverage of the Justice Department's decision not to prosecute Goldman Sachs in a financial fraud probe. We'll also talk about the trial of the Russian protest rock band Pussy Riot and freedom of expression in Russia. We'll be joined by Reuters' Rob Cox, McClatchy's Kevin Hall, and independent journalist Masha Gassin. Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. What did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.